Foreign Affairs 2 by Lieutenant L.J., a.k.a. Victoria Custer. Read by Library Chick 94. Fandom, Stargate Atlantis. Relationship, John Shepard, other male character. Rating is general. Part 4 of the Hunting Parties series. The next time they went back to Tassaban, it was because the Tassaban sent for them. It feels strange to ask for help from off-world, Van Ryn admitted. Some of the others think it is a waste of effort, Banat shrugged wearily. I told them it was worth a try. It is our only chance, Van Ryn thought, but kept it to himself. It was near evening, the sun vanishing behind the distant mountains, and the tribe was camped, trapped, on the flat plain of the high desert, far from any sheltering rock. The tents provided the only cover, the material flapping in the dusty wind. They camped out in the open only when it was unavoidable, and never in this season, when the rains brought color to the sparse grasses and the gully bottoms. If the wraith came, it was usually this time of year. Few people moved between the tents, all near stumbling from exhaustion. That first night was when the old and the young had fallen ill, and they had been trapped here for 7 days now, with too many sick to move. Van Ryn and Banat and the garrison who had been guarding the ring had arrived 4 days ago in response to messages for help, and since then things had only gotten worse. Doctor had determined that it was poison and not disease, but no one seemed to be getting better, and they had to make constant trips to the spring that was nearly a day's ride away. The closer well was probably the source of the poison. Van Ryn put thoughts of imminent death aside and said, "With luck, Redan will reach the ring tomorrow morning." If the address worked, and if the Atlanteans sent their communication device to an answer, if Redan managed to make himself understood. Redan spoke very little of the trade language, and Van Ryn had tried to teach him the message by rote, but he couldn't leave the camp to go himself. There were decisions that had to be made here. If no help came, the decisions would become much harder. "We know that they live in a city of the ancestors, but did they ever say how close it was to their ring?" Banat asked. "If it takes a long time for the message to be carried from their ring to their city..." Van Ryn shook his head. He knew John would help them if he could, and he knew that John might not be there to receive the message himself. If help was granted, there was no judging how long it would take to arrive, how long it would take Redan to guide them back here. "We won't know for days yet." He sighed and clapped Banat on the shoulder, pretending he wasn't near dead from exhaustion himself. "Come, we'll need to go for water again tonight." Van Ryn had forgotten how swiftly the Atlanteans could travel. The next morning, he was tying the empty waterskins to the sumpter's saddle, wearily preparing for another trip to the nearest safe spring, when someone shouted. Several men were in the open, pointing up, and for a moment his heart froze. Wraith, he thought. And why are they just standing there? Then his eyes found the square silver craft, floating in midair. The camp stirred like a startled insect nest. Some were afraid, while those who had seen the Atlanteans before waved to it and called out reassurances to the others. The craft hesitated, as if making sure of its welcome, and then began to slowly drift toward an open area at the edge of the camp. By the time Van Ryn reached it, it had settled to the ground in a cloud of dust, and the backside was unfolding to become a walkway. As it opened fully, he saw there was at least a dozen people milling inside, all in the gray and black that the Atlanteans wore. Redan bounded out first, saying, "You would not believe how fast!" Then John was walking down the ramp, carrying unimaginably deadly weapons, wearing the heavy garments that pretended to conceal everything, but just drew attention to his slim waist and the curve of his lower back. "Van Ryn, Redan said a bunch of people had been poisoned?" Van Ryn managed to reply, "Yes, we know it must be the nearest well, but the sickness it caused is unusual." He realized Redan was right. He didn't believe it. He hadn't really thought help would come, or not soon enough to make a difference. He knew this was how tribes died, trapped in the open desert by bad water holes. Part of him had already given up. The other Atlanteans were coming out of the craft, men and women both, burdened with crates and strange devices. John touched the communications device in his ear and said, "Stackhouse, this is Shepard. Dial base and tell them we're going to need the big water tanks. The supply here is contaminated." He looked at Van Ryn closely and must have seen that he was dazed. "Hey, it's going to be okay. We're going to figure this out." Van Ryn squeezed his shoulder in gratitude, shock turning to relief. "Yes, I think we will." John was worried about Van Ryn, who looked like he hadn't slept in days, but the first thing they had to do was get Beckett and his medical team started. Most of the Tassaban who were still mobile enough to help with the sick had already gathered around the jumper. John was glad to see that the group included Doctor, the Tassavan version of Beckett, except much older and much more naked. Beckett had brought enough equipment for a portable lab, plus several nurses and med techs. John had brought his team and four extra Marines and stationed Stackhouse's team with Jumper 3 at the gate for coordination and backup. Redan knew more English than John knew Tassavan, but he hadn't been easy to understand. John hadn't been sure if they were looking at providing assistance on the ground or coordinating a full evacuation. With Vanden translating, there was a three-cornered conversation between Beckett and Doctor, with several other Tassavan listening worriedly while John got the team started on the unloading. "They don't sound thrilled," Rodney pointed out, carrying a crate over to the stack. "I have the feeling that the usual quality of off-world medical assistance in this galaxy doesn't inspire confidence." John had been keeping one ear on the conversation and knew he was right. "Give it a few minutes. We just got here." "Hauling a bag of supplies," Taylor put in. "Most of them have never been through the gate, so I can understand why they might be doubtful." Then Banat, the old guy who had been John's chaperone on his first stay here, dragged over a large folded tent. "That's for us?" John asked, trying to get the question across with gestures. "For the lab?" Banat nodded, and with various gestures indicated that this was for the Atlanteans to use. John called over Ford, Ramirez, and Audley. "Ford, we're going to help set up this tent." "Yes, sir," Ford said, eyeing the pile of leather tarp and braided rope. "Wouldn't it go faster if we just let them do it?" John bit his lip and had to concede the point. "Probably, but we're going to help anyway." It actually went a lot quicker than John had expected, mainly because all Banat needed was people to hang onto the ropes and help unroll the tarps. They had the tent about halfway up when Vanden waved John over, saying, "Doctor wants to see your feet." "What? Oh." John sat down on the sandy ground and started unlacing his boots. Doctor crouched down, waiting impatiently. He looked exhausted, too, though under all the gray hair, beads, and bones, it was harder to tell. When he had his boots off, Doctor ran a callous thumb over the faint scars on John's feet, making a show of checking Beckett's work. The other Tassavan gathered nearby leaned over to watch. Beckett said, "You wouldn't believe what we had to do to him to get him to stay off his feet long enough to recover." Vanden translated this for Doctor, then listened to Doctor's reply. He smiled faintly. "He says he would believe it." "Hey," John protested. Doctor nodded approval, gave John a pat on the head, then stood up and addressed the crowd, gesturing broadly to Beckett. "I think you're getting your license to practice medicine on Tassavan," John told Beckett, wrestling his boots back on. "What about the blood tests?" Beckett asked Vanden. "Did he agree to that? I can demonstrate the procedure on the Major if he wants to see it." "Or Ford," John pointed out. "I think it's Ford's turn." Taking blood for analysis wasn't common knowledge in a lot of the non-technological cultures, so they were used to having to do the human pincushion demonstration. Vanden told Beckett, "He is explaining that to them now, and tells them that he understands the principle as you have explained it, and feels it is necessary." He added wryly, "He is also making the point that we have asked for your help, and that it would be rude to object to your methods." "They are agreeing." Beckett looked relieved. "You all don't know what a relief it is to work with reasonable people for a change." "Yeah, normally you just have to work with us," John said, getting to his feet. There was a crackle in his headset, and he looked up to see Jumper 3 circling the camp. "That's Markham with the water tank," he told Vanden. "Where do you want to put it? It's pretty big." Vanden shaded his eyes to see the jumper. "How long will it last?" John shrugged. "As long as you need it. When it runs out, we'll bring out another one. Take this one back to refill." For a moment, Vanden just looked floored. John asked worriedly, "Hey, you okay?" Vanden laughed a little and squeezed John's shoulder again. "Yes. Now." After setting up the power transfer device from the jumper and getting Carson's portable lab up and running, Rodney worked with the other non-medical personnel, carrying water from the tank to the tents, being asked repeatedly why he hadn't discovered an anti-gravity lifting device, and explaining acidly to the Marines why Star Wars wasn't always the best indication of what ancient technology might have to offer. Finally, they had the water and supplies distributed throughout the camp. Then Rodney fixed the big holographic display for the ancient scanner, yelled at the techs for breaking it, then went looking for Shepard. He found him standing in the entrance to one of the tents, gazing thoughtfully off across the camp. He was holding a Tassavan baby that was determinedly gumming a pocket flap of his tack vest. Rodney frowned. "Where did you get that? I thought it was just the male tribe here." Shepard absently bounced the baby, which gurgled and grabbed for his lower lip. They had a small group of women and kids with them, taking them back to the winter caves. The kids were too young to travel far, and it's a shorter trip this way. Were? Riding was uneasy at the choice of words. That's not the only one. No, they're okay, Shepard said hurriedly. A harried medtech stepped out of the tent, and Shepard handed off the baby. The women aren't in such great shape. They were giving all their water to the kids, but Beckett thinks they'll make it. That's a relief. Because granted, this wasn't the first time they had had people help them because they were desperate to get into Shepard's pants, but it always ended badly, and this hadn't. And tumbling out of the gate from Icy Death Planet to be saved by armed naked women was a fond memory that was going to last Rodney a long time. And he knew what would have happened to Shepard if Vandren hadn't gotten him out of the Isvini camp. Then Shepard touched his headset, his gaze sharpening. Hey, Beckett's found something. They had the meeting outside the lab tent, because Doctor had conked out earlier and was asleep on a cot inside. Well, we found it, and the Tassabin were right. It was a contaminant, Beckett said, once they had gathered around. Fortunately, it's not going to cause anyone any permanent damage. The biggest danger was dehydration from the nausea. Now, the odd thing is, we were expecting to find some sort of bacteria, but this looks more like a toxic compound. I've sent the blood samples back to Atlantis so Bureau can have a look at it for the full medical database, but I need a water sample from the contaminated well itself. Vandren frowned, shaking his head. There was no one out here who would poison a well. There are other tribes in the deeper desert, not part of ours, but we all use the wells. What about the Isvini, John said. When Redan had first shown up and said poison, the first thing he had thought of was Isvini, either a new group who had managed to get through while the gate was unguarded, or survivors hiding out somewhere. We can't be sure we got all of them. But would they poison a well? Rodney asked. He waved a hand. Wait, let me rephrase that. Of course they would poison a well. But would they be able to do it this effectively? Remember, we aren't talking about the brain trust of the Pegasus Galaxy. Vandren frowned, shaking his head. I agree, I'm not certain they would even be able to survive this long in the desert, let alone find that well. He told Beckett, I will get a sample of the water for you. Still thinking of his Vini, John caught his eye and said, I'll come with you. Beckett needed Jumper 1 supplies and power sources, and Jumper 3 was changing out the water tank, so they were going to take one of the buffalo things. John had never seen them do anything but stand like furry rocks, but when they walked up to the one tight outside Vandren's tent, it stretched its big head out toward him, making snuffling noises. That was when he noticed just how wide its jaw was. He stopped. Does it bite? Not you, Vandren grinned at him and swung up onto the creature's back. He held out a hand to John. When I first brought you to the caves, the others wondered if the Isvini had kept you for some time and starved you. I told them that you were too strong to be starved and that they would know that if they had to wrestle you onto the back of a sumpter. Hey, you scared the hell out of me. John took his hand, got a foothold on the saddle pad, and swung awkwardly up behind him. Settling in, he managed not to do the first thing that occurred to him and nuzzle the back of Vandren's neck. There were long straps on the saddle pad to hold on to, as if the animal was meant to be ridden by several people at once. It took a step, the muscles rolling under the furry back, and John grabbed the strap. It was like riding a large walking couch. They headed away toward the angular shapes of the rocky outcrops in the distance. The yellow-tinted sky was mostly clear, only a few clouds and a little dust in the air. Looking back at the camp, John saw there was somebody standing on top of the jumper, filming DV. He guessed who it was by the height and weight, and keyed his radio to say, Lieutenant Ford, Private Yamato is requesting a job, preferably involving latrines. Yes, sir. Fortunately, Nurse Harpreet is looking for somebody to help with bedpans, Ford replied, as the figure scrambled off the jumper. Vandren laughed. You are very strict with them. Not really, John grinned, thinking about how Bates would react to that statement. Then he realized he was riding into the desert on an alien planet on a short bantha. Some days this job is pretty cool, he thought. After a moment, Vandren asked, What did they do to you, to make you recover, as Beckett said? Oh, that. John looked out toward the mountains, dark outlines against the sky. I had to go to the mainland and live with Taylor's people, the Athosians, for a month. This did not sound like a terrible fate. Yeah, well, I thought they were sending me away for a different reason, John admitted. He shifted uncomfortably, only partly because of the sumpter's rolling gait. I'm not big on being sent away, even for my own good. Vandren let that go for a moment, then said, There's something I always wondered about. What? John asked warily. Why do none of the others have pointed ears? They were far enough away from the camp by that point, so John bit him in the shoulder. That is not an acceptable question, Vandren guessed, sounding amused. They had been riding for nearly an hour, and for a while it had been obvious that a storm was coming up. The gray clouds were getting that particular yellow tint John could recognize now, and the wind was turning fitful. The outcrop that sheltered the well had been growing steadily closer, and John figured they were only a couple of miles away when the Sumpter stopped abruptly. "Storm," Vandren said, sounding startled. John twisted around to look. "Crap!" In the distance, a giant brown wall was rolling across the desert, heading toward them. John keyed the radio. "Ford, this is Shepard. We've got a big storm coming out of the north." "South," Vandren corrected, urging the Sumpter to kneel down. "And tell him to tell the others it is a Sabadeen." "South," John amended, "and tell the Tassabin it's a Sabadeen." "Copy that, Major." From Ford's voice, he was running, and John could hear excited voices in the background. "Do you need assistance? Should we take the jumper out to—" "Negative. There's no time." They had 5 minutes at best before it hit. "We'll be okay where we are." Or at least John hoped so. As soon as they were off its back, the Sumpter sank down into the sand, tucking its head in and becoming a large furry rock. Vandren pulled a couple of cords in the saddle pad and unfurled a big leather flap. John grabbed the edge, helping him to stretch it out. One side was permanently attached to the saddle pad, so the whole thing formed a lean-to against the side of the animal. Vandren used a heavy metal stake to ram one corner into the ground. At his urgent wave, John ducked underneath, scooting in close to the Sumpter's furry side. It was dark under there already, the air thick and musty with the scent of the animal's fur. Vandren ducked in after John, working to get the other side staked down. The last of the light vanished as Vandren got the flap sealed. John felt him crawl up next to the Sumpter and shifted over to make room. It had already been clear to John that this was not your normal storm, not the kind that the Tassabin had used as cover against the Isvini, not the kind that were just inconvenient. When Vandren put an arm around his shoulders, pulling John down into his lap and huddling over on top of him, John knew it was even worse than he had thought. He wrapped an arm around Vandren's waist and hung on. The storm roared over them, wind and sand hitting with an almost explosive impact. John flinched, felt Vandren tense. A vibration traveled through the Sumpter's body as if it had groaned in protest. Maybe that was the worst, John thought. His ears were ringing, but at least they were still breathing and the tent hadn't collapsed. After a time, Vandren sat up, some of the tension leaving his body. John pushed himself up, but the wind was still too loud to ask if the chances for survival were rising or falling. Then Vandren brushed a thumb against his cheek, slid his hand to the back of John's neck, pulling him in for a kiss. Startled and amused, John snorted against his mouth. Hopefully this was relief that they were going to live. John twisted for a better angle and got jabbed by the P-90. Swearing, he pulled away from Vandren to snap it off his vest strap and set it aside. By that time, he could feel Vandren shaking with laughter. John grabbed his shoulders and straddled his lap. They were kissing like teenagers. It was dark. There was no air and no room to move. All John needed was a gear shift wedged into his kidney to trigger a flashback. Vandren had tugged his tack vest and jacket open and had one hand under John's shirt and the other down the back of his pants. Then John heard something that wasn't the wind. They both froze at the same moment. That was a voice, John thought. Somewhere outside their shelter, over the dying wind, someone had shouted. Vandren eased back, whispering, "Do you hear?" "Yeah." John kept his voice low. He took his hand out from under Vandren's kilt to fumble for the base unit of his radio. "Somebody from the camp?" "No." Vandren lifted John off his lap. "They know we took shelter. They have no reason to come after us." John keyed the radio and whispered, "Ford, come in. This is Shepard." Ford replied almost immediately, "Yes, Major, this is Ford." "What's your situation?" John picked up the P-90. He heard Vandren shifting around, moving to the edge of the tent. "We're secure. The storm hit pretty hard, but none of the tents came down." Over the radio, John could hear voices in the background, speaking in English and Tassabin, and a tent flapping in the wind. It all sounded calm and normal. "Copy that. Did anybody from camp come up here after us?" A line of gray light appeared as Vandren edged the flap up a little to peer out. John crawled over to join him. He squinted, but all he could see was sand and blowing dust. "Negative, sir." Ford's voice sharpened with concern. "Sir, do you need assistance?" "Not just yet." Then Vandren nudged his shoulder and pointed. John caught a glimpse of movement, realized it was the furry feet of another Sumpter. John told Ford, "Looks like there's somebody else up here. If I don't contact you in 20 minutes, scramble a jumper." Affirmative, sir. There was another shout from outside. Vanren pushed the tent flap up and stood. John scrambled out after him in time to see a startled group of men back away. They were all Tassabin, big guys with tattoos, piercings, but there was something different about them. John realized the tattoos were different from the ones worn by Vanren's tribes. The designs were blocky and crude, not as finely detailed, and the colors were not as vibrant. For a long moment, everybody just stared. Three sumpters were standing not far away, shaking the sand out of their fur. Then Vanren said something to the men in Tassavin. Nobody replied. John pushed to his feet slowly, standing next to Vanren. For a long stretch of a moment, nobody said anything. The stranger stared at Vanren and stared at John. It occurred to John that he had no idea what Tassabin intertribal relations were like, if these guys were enemies or just strangers. And he felt stupidly exposed, standing here with his vest and jacket open and his shirt hanging out, and possibly a hickey on his neck. Vanren spoke to them again, and finally one of the men replied. They talked back and forth for a few moments, and John was getting the idea that Vanren didn't like what he was hearing. Not taking his eyes off the men, Vanren said to John, he sends his name is Selin. They are deep desert people. They have heard of off-worlders, but not seen one before. John was getting a bad vibe here. There was a distinct sense of hostility in the air. But these men weren't armed, and he didn't want this to end with him shooting anybody, but he wasn't going to let it end with him and Vanren getting jumped either. There was another conversation, and Vanren was starting to look angry. He said tightly, I am asking him if he knew the well had turned bad, and he will not give me a clear answer. The same man, Selin, spoke again, then started toward them. He stopped barely a pace away, jerked his head toward John, and said something that made Vanren's eyes go hooded and his whole body tense. Oh, great, John thought, his eyes narrowing. Selin apparently had a problem with Vanren being out here with an off-worlder, and it looked like he meant to make an issue of it. Selin started to step forward, still looking at John. Then Vanren planted a hand in Selin's chest and shoved him away, hard enough to make him stagger back and nearly fall. John tightened his grip on the P-90. If this escalated, he was going to shoot in the air first and just hope that scared them off. Selin stood there for a long moment, then threw one more dark look at Vanren before he turned away, going back to the others. The whole group retreated, climbing up into the waiting sumpters and heading off across the desert. John let out his breath, relieved. They stood there, watching the figures grow smaller with distance. Vanren finally said grimly, That was unpleasant. Yeah, John looked around. The rest of the landscape was empty, just rolling swells of sand, stretching out to the sharp outlines of the rocks. So were they heading toward the well, or were they following us? Because if this group had trailed them from the camp, it meant they had been watching from a distance, knowing Vanren's tribe was in trouble and doing nothing to help. And 10 extra men could have carried a lot of water in the past few days. Vanren sighed and dropped an arm around John's shoulders, squeezing absently. That is a good question. The sumpter stood up, shaking the sand out of its fur, spraying them both. That, Vanren said, startled, was not here earlier. John swung down off the sumpter. Yeah, I think you guys would have noticed that. The well was in the rocks at the base of the outcrop, but it was barely visible now. The bluff above it had collapsed in a jumble of sand and gravel, revealing a smooth section of pewter-colored metal. Ancient metal. I had noticed the rock was eroding, but none of this was visible. Vanren slid down off the sumpter. This is of the ancestors? John nodded, picking his way through the rocks for a better look. And I bet that's where the poison in the well came from. If the ground shifted, it could have broken through all kinds of conduit, leaking who knows what into the water. He tapped his radio. Ford, this is Shepard. We're going to need that jumper after all. And Rodney. It was late that evening, the sky going dark purple with twilight, when John got a relayed call from Stackhouse, telling him Atlantis had requested he return to base to deal with a problem with one of their other trade partners. Rodney, Taylor, and Ford had come in Jumper 3 to help do the initial survey of the well site, and Rodney had been pretty intrigued with what he'd been able to find so far. John broke the news to him, and he bitched a lot about not being able to stay out here all night to find a way into the bluff, then admitted that this was actually a job for archaeology and geology, and he wouldn't be able to do much of anything until they got inside the structure, whenever that was. That settled, John went to look for Vanren and found him on the other side of the rocks with the sumpter. "There's news?" Vanren asked. He was checking the animal's big flat feet for gravel and straightened up as John approached. Not about the camp. Everything's still fine there, John said reluctantly. We got a call from base. I need to get back. I'll leave Sergeant Stackhouse and the other Marines at the camp with Beckett's team until your people are back on their feet. Van Ryn regarded him for a moment and then smiled a little. I do not know what I can do to thank you. John had several ideas of how Van Ryn could thank him, but the request to return to Atlantis had ruined those plans. Rodney's going to want a better look at this place, and we might be able to seal off whatever's leaking, do something about the well. He patted the Sumter's broad forehead, and it groaned and leaned toward him. We'll be back. Van Ryn stepped close, brushed his fingers against John's cheek. He said seriously, I know what your people's rules are, and I had meant to stop breaking them, to return their prince to them unmolested this time, but I lost my resolve. Yeah, there wasn't much time for molesting, John agreed glumly. The Sumter nudged him, and John stumbled into Van Ryn's chest. Okay, that was an accident. Van Ryn cupped his chin. Then from behind the rocks, John heard Rodney say, They're back here, doing a scene from the French lieutenant's woman. John swore. He heard Ford tell Rodney, You know, if I was him, I'd punch you in the mouth. Taylor cleared her throat and said loudly, Major, we are ready to leave. Van Ryn sighed and reluctantly let John go. Return when you can. The end. The story can be found at archiveofourown.org/works/11930.